It's the spring of 1864, and a new kind of fishing vessel is headed north along the Norwegian coast to Finnmark, Norway's northernmost county. The ship is owned and captained by a 55-year-old Norwegian sealer turned whaler named Sven Foyn. His ship is named Spes et Fides, Latin for hope and faith. Foyn has hope and faith in this journey, but as history will show, his technological advances will become disastrous for whales. Bristling from the bow of the ship are seven brand new harpoon guns that he himself designed. Unlike the harpoons that have been used by whalers in the past, this design is a
exploding harpoon, right, so that you can kill the whale quickly.
In spite of the lethal nature of these harpoons, things didn't go that well. There was a rope attached to the harpoon, of course, but when the first harpoon was fired, the rope wrapped itself around Foyn's foot and tightened as the whale sounded. Foyn disappeared overboard in a flash. It looked as if this first experiment would be his last. But somehow, when the whale resurfaced, the line went slack. Foyn, shaken but alive, swam back to the boat. "Damn, I thought the captain drowned," one of the cabin boys yelled. Foyn caught just three whales that season and spent the next 3 years perfecting his harpoon. There were more mishaps along the way. At one point when the crew harpooned a whale, they missed the vital organs and the whale, very much alive, took the Spes et Fides for a 12-hour-long ride in a stiff gale before Foyn ordered the line be cut. But by 1868, the exploding harpoon was a success, for the humans anyway. Instead of three whales that season, Foyn caught 30. In fact, historians date the modern age of whaling to this period.
And of course, our good friend Sven Foyn began with his series of, not just one, but a series of inventions that really kick-started the massive whale industry of the 20th century. So it's a big advance over the sort of Moby Dick stuff that we all know about from the Herman Melville era.
These inventions were so effective that by the 1960s, many whale populations worldwide had been driven to the brink of extinction. Technology, courtesy of Norway's Sven Foyn, drove this awful trend. The question now is, can technology help save them? I'm Nancy Basilchuk, and you're listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from NTNU, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Whales are the largest living mammals on Earth. They have been hunted over the centuries, and most populations are now endangered. So how can technology be harnessed to help us protect whales so that their populations can recover? Today, I'm going to tell you two related stories that answer that exact question. One is about an underwater fiber optic cable strung between two remote locations on Svalbard, the Norwegian High Arctic Archipelago, with two postdoctoral researchers sitting and combing through 250 terabytes of data for a whole summer, and without even seeing an actual physical whale. The second is about a researcher who has traveled around the globe cataloging whale dialects so they can be used, in combination with artificial intelligence, to help prevent ship strikes in heavily traveled shipping lanes. And we'll let the whales do some talking too. But first, a little more about the history of whaling and why whales were worth hunting nearly to extinction. Because it turns out that Norway, above and beyond the inventive Sven Foyn, played a huge role in this history as well.
Let's start with the turn of the 20th century. So we're talking about the birth of the really big modern whaling industry.
That's
Jennifer L. Bailey. I'm professor of political science at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology in the Department of Sociology and Political Science. So the objective here is whale oil, and it has a multiple number of uses in a highly industrialized society. It's very good as lubrication. So back in the 70s, when the American whale anti-whaling movement was getting going, the U.S. Department of Commerce had to ask the U.S. Navy, for example, whether there were substitutes for some of the uses of sperm oil in submarines. So there was at least a question raised about the defense applications of this highly useful lubricant. Of course, in modern days, a lot of it's used for food oils, the fats, and so forth, going into food products, particularly after World War II, when there was a worldwide shortage of fats and oils. And suddenly, you needed a lot of fats and oils very quickly. And of course, a lot of the livestock were killed off during the Second World War. So there was a real need, worldwide need for whaling, and that kick-started or really helped the whaling industry, which obviously had been depressed by the Second World War, just really come on board again, and also led to the modern movement against whaling.
But eventually, Norway also recognized that you couldn't simply take whales indefinitely without irreversibly destroying whale stocks.
As you look at the increase in the number of whales, particularly from the south between like 1904 and the late 20s, you see Norway also being a leader and beginning to say that maybe we should put some controls on the takes of whales. Now, a lot of this has to do with the fact that there's an overproduction of whale oil, particularly as you get into the Depression. So you have a lot of whale catchers and a lot of production of whale oil, but a flooding of the market. So Norway starts to actually be taking the lead in trying to reduce at least the amount of whale oil on the market, if not the number of whales taken.
The International Whaling Commission, the IWC, was established in 1946, right after the end of the Second World War, when there's lots of pressure on whaling stocks, as Jennifer explained. But eventually, given the intense hunting and the development of alternative products, as well as the growing environmental movement, whales became less important commercially. Eventually, in 1982, the commission proposed a ban on all commercial whaling. Norway protested against the ban because they felt the science behind it was weak.
So what is Norway doing today? Norway is whaling under objection. So when the moratorium is adopted, different countries, countries could register an objection because this is an international whaling commission. It's an international organization. Countries retain sovereignty. Norway said, we reserve our position here. We object to this. They voluntarily stopped commercial whaling for a few years, did some research, and then when they resumed whaling, it was whaling within the Norwegian economic zone, and it was only the minke whale, which is the smallest whale, and they used an algorithm approved by the science committee of the IWC to establish that it be done in a sustainable manner.
We'll leave the debate about whether or not it's right for Norway to continue hunting minke whales to another podcast. Needless to say, most whale populations are so critically low, they need help. And that brings us back to the role that new technologies can play in boosting whale populations now that they are protected.
So we had this project where we wanted to study the effect on seismic acoustic on whales, on marine mammals. In Norway, the main focus has up to then been very much on fish.
That's Martin Landre, a geophysicist at NTNU's Department of Electronic Systems. He spent a lot of his career figuring out how to study what's going on under the seabed. Sometimes it's to help petroleum geologists find oil or learn more about other geological processes like plate tectonics. That's the driving process behind earthquakes, volcanoes, and mountain building. One way geophysicists study what's under the sea is by doing something called seismic surveys. They set off explosions in the water using something called air guns and measure how long it takes for the sound to return to the hydrophones that are strung out behind the boat. Different materials under the seafloor, like, say, porous sandstone filled with petroleum, have different sound signatures. Geophysicists can analyze these signals and figure out what's down there. It's kind of like taking an ultrasound of the ocean bottom. The problem is that these airgun explosions aren't necessarily that nice for the creatures that live in the ocean. So, Martin was asked to find out how seismic surveys would affect blue whales because...
Blue whales, they are communicating in the same frequency range as the seismic. So they are talking the same language. It's the frequencies between, say, 5 to 80 hertz. That's where the blue whales like to talk. They're talking with very deep voice. So they are special in that sense. Humpback whales, for instance, they can be quite deep, but they can also go into the kilohertz range like you and me when we are talking. But blue whales are very low frequency.
Ooh. So he headed to Iceland to listen in on blue whales that are known to feed in a bay in northeastern Iceland called Húsavík. Unfortunately, the blue whales didn't cooperate. Humpbacks? Yes. Blue whales? No.
So we got a lot of nice photos of humpback whales and recordings of humpback whales. But that was not the purpose.
And then he had an aha moment. It turns out, at the same time, Martin was experimenting with fiber optic cables to see how well they could pick up sounds from the Earth, from a distance. Remember, he's a geophysicist who's trying to listen to the planet in as many ways as he can. Fiber optic cables are the thin glass fibers that are the backbone of modern internet communication. They transmit information in the form of light. But Martin, he realized they could also be used to collect other information.
And that's when I got this idea that this can be used for listening to whales.
Martin does some experiments in Trondheim Fjord to see how good the technology is at picking up sounds in the ocean. He finds a fiber optic cable that extends out to Rissa, about 50 kilometers from Trondheim, out towards the coast.
So we get access to that fiber, and we did a small test where we went out with Gunnerus, the university vessel. We had a small acoustic source on board, and we kind of traversed along the fiber, for seismic, but much weaker. It was not an air gun. It was a source that is just doing a bit higher than this, I would say. Yeah. And then we were able to see that even a fairly weak signal was detectable on this cable.
And then the COVID-19 shutdown happened. In Norway, this was March 12th, 2020. But talk about turning lemons into lemonade. After some hunting around to find a fiber optic setup in a place where there would be whales, Martin realized that there was a cable in Svalbard that linked the main town, Longyearbyen, to a little research community about 120 kilometers away called Nyolesund. And because, well, of COVID, some of the equipment he needed to borrow wasn't in high demand. One particular piece of equipment has the rather alarming name of the interrogator. And the main job of the interrogator is to send a laser beam through the fiber optic cable and measure the light that comes back. The whole system, the interrogator and the fiber optic cable, is called distributed acoustic sensing. Or if you're a scientist, DAS. So, how does that help us detect whale sounds? Martin explains.
So distributed acoustic sensing means that you are listening to sound, to acoustics, using light that you send in a fiber, in a glass fiber. And these fibers are what we are using every day. They are when we are looking, watching our television, when we are communicating. We use fibers a lot. And these type of fibers we can also use to listen to sound. And the principle is that when the light hits small impurities or inhomogeneities in the fiber, some of the light, a very small percentage, will be scattered back.
So the researchers aren't actually listening to sound, but are measuring how a sound causes a fiber to move, just a teeny bit.
When you have a strong or weaker signal that hits the fiber, these small inhomogeneities, they move a bit, and we are able to measure that small movement, which is a stretch or a strain. So what we measure is a strain in the fiber. But once you have something that is changing, a person walking by, a whale, or an explosion, or a ship, that will create a strain change in the fiber. And that we can measure down to a precision of nanometers. So it's very precise because we use light to measure this.
While the technology isn't new, it has developed rapidly over the past 5 years. And because it is very precise, a fiber optic cable can measure sound along distances of up to 220 kilometers. Martin was able to collect 40 days of data from the Svalbard setup in the summer of 2020. It generated an enormous amount of information, 7 terabytes a day. So he set 2 postdoctoral researchers working on this project. One of them was
Léa Bouffaud.
Léa is French and did her PhD at the Naval Academy Research Institute in Brest, France. She studied Antarctic blue whales in the Indian Ocean and came to NTNU to work with Martin.
Initially, we were working on the impact of air guns on the behavior of marine mammals. Turns out we had DAS and this fiber optic work to start with, and this is mostly what we've been doing.
And here's some of what they heard. So, how do they actually know this is a whale?
I get this question a lot, actually, even from bioacousticians. They're like, but how do you know this is a whale? I always tell them, like, if you don't think about technology, how do you know it's a whale when you record it from a hydrophone? From frequency, from the pattern, from the repetition, from you listen to it and, you know, like, and the literature, of course, supports, like, you look for patterns that are known, at least initially.
During 40 days of listening in on these signals picked up by the fiber optic cable, the researchers identified hundreds of different sounds. A lot of them were caused by storms, earthquakes, and ships passing over or near the cable. But one day, Léa hears what she has been waiting for.
Yeah, I think the day I knew I had a blue whale stereotype signal, these are the ones that you cannot be wrong about them. You know what it is when you see them. Then I was just like, wow, that's it. That's it. Like, that's what we were looking for. And this moment, I was just, this is my happiest day. Let's keep it like this.
I think it's the first time I've used DAS to listen to blue whales.
So, how does eavesdropping on whales help protect them? Well, most whale species are critically endangered, as we know. It's really hard to track their numbers because there aren't a lot of them to begin with. And they live in the ocean. Yes, you can go on cruises and deploy hydrophones. You can monitor them from the air. You can attach tags to them. But all of these approaches have their limitations. But here's the thing. Right now, there are more than 1.2 million kilometers of fiber optic cables that have been laid in all the world's oceans. So this is a potential global network.
The fact that fiber optic cables are all around the world, it makes them accessible. So there are hurdles in it. They belong to companies, you need agreements. The interrogator is yet still quite expensive.
Remember, the interrogator is the gadget that sends the laser signals through the fiber optic cable.
But in the long run, it gives access to a wide variety of scientists. It gives them access to in situ recordings. And I think this is very important Because whales, well, when we talk about whales, which is what I'm interested in, they're migratory species.
Leah points out that the whales don't recognize international boundaries. So it doesn't help if only a few countries try to protect them, if they spend half their year in areas where they're not so protected. That means we need to know a lot more about their movements over the course of a year. Or what about in the Arctic, where whales already spend a lot of their time? What's going to happen as the Arctic gets warmer?
Svalbard is a perfect example. It is changing very fast. And the use of both animal use of this area and human use of the area is changing as basically as fast as the ice melts. And those species that are, like, we're looking at what we call baleen whales, which are like the large whales such as blue whales and fin whales and maybe humpbacks and sei whales. They're not year-long residents of that location, but because the ice is melting away, those species have been seen to go every year more up north. So we are talking about a poleward shift of a lot of baleen whale species. And they might actually at some point come there all year round. There are already evidences that fin whales do stay around quite a long time of the year, longer than before. And so, but at the same time, our use is changing of those locations. We have, with the ice melting, there are discussions about a cross-Arctic shipping route that would be year-long shipping route. But if those species are changing and maybe using this area for more than foraging or for activities where they're very vulnerable, then having this type of technology under it can help us spot. And the beauty as well is that we can do that right now. We don't have the algorithm to do it in real time, but the technology works in real time.
Martin and his colleagues are still working with this idea. In fact, this year they have nearly real-time monitoring on that stretch of cable to see what they can see. The idea is that at some point, this Arctic fiber optic cable network could allow real-time detection of whales. As more and more ships travel to the Arctic, whether for transport or with tourists, that information could be used to warn ships away from where the whales are. Because with the moratorium on whaling, one of the major causes of whale mortality is by being struck by ships. And that's where another NTNU researcher comes into the picture.
My name is Anna Širović, and I'm an associate professor at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. I like to refer myself as a marine bioacoustician because my field is really this wonderful combination of biology and sound, acoustics, oceanography, all of it. So the Benioff Ocean Initiative was looking for manageable conservation problems to try to help and resolve. That's how WhaleSafe came about. And WhaleSafe is a tool that uses a variety of inputs, one of which is acoustic input, to provide information on the likelihood of whale presence in shipping lanes off the U.S. West Coast, off of California.
One of the key pieces of information that Anna was able to bring to this project was an extensive library of whale calls. Because much of her research has been in the Pacific, turns out whales have their own dialects. The west coast of California is home to the busiest port in all of the U.S., the Port of Los Angeles. It's estimated that about 80 whales, mostly blue, fin, and humpback whales are killed every year in this area because of ship strikes. That may not seem like a lot, but there are only an estimated 10,000 to 25,000 blue whales in the whole world.
And so we started this project about three years ago, and 2 years ago the first setup went operational. And so I'm part of a team with Mark Baumgartner of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And he had developed buoys that send near real-time data to provide information on the presence of calling whales. And Mark had developed this tool that worked on the East Coast and of the United States. And some of the species are similar on the West Coast, the calls that they produce are very different. They each have their own dialects. So we had to adapt his AI tools, his automated detector tools, to work on those new dialects. And so I had spent a lot of time working on the species on the in the Pacific. And so we combined our libraries and allowed it to annotate and kind of learn how to detect those calls. And then that's also coupled with visual observations from whale watching boats in the area, and also colleagues from NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. They have developed habitat models. They use satellite data to get a prediction of likelihood of whale occurrence in the area. So we combine these three data streams into one metric of likelihood of whales, and that then can get sent out to ships, to really any interested party, and alert them whether there's likely to be whales in the area where they're passing. And then they can decide to slow down their ships and reduce the risk of collision with large whales.
Anna has only been at NTNU since 2021, so she's just getting started listening to the waters off of Norway.
I think Norway is a super exciting place to be for bioacoustics because there's such a long coastline and so much diversity along the coastline. And there has been relatively little effort to collect recordings along this whole area. Currently, there's a lot of increased awareness about noise and the impact of noise on marine life, and that's where there's a lot of funding that I see coming. So I have two projects to look at impacts of various aspects of anthropogenic sounds on different parts of the marine ecosystem, on zooplankton and on fish. So I think that's a very exciting and very important area that there's going to, I think, be a lot of work to be done. But also, I'm personally interested in these long-term changes that are happening in our ecosystems everywhere. And so starting a library, long-term library of underwater recordings, I think is really going to be a valuable thing.
Like Leia, Anna sees the value of being able to keep an eye on what's happening to the creatures living in the oceans as the climate changes over the next decades. Anna says a long-term library of recordings is a little like saving audio snapshots of the past. They can remind us of how the oceans have changed over time.
Acoustics are a very good tool for getting long-term records. And I keep coming back to this theme of long-term records, but I think we're at this point now where we're experiencing so many changes in our environment, and it's very easy to forget how things were because you forget. And having long-term records will allow us to go back and then compare how things are today versus how they were 10 or 15 or more years ago. And I think we'll need records like that to actually keep reminding ourselves of where we're going and how the planet is changing. The cool thing about it is we know so little about underwater sounds that just about any time I put a recorder in a new place, I hear something that just is wild and amazing and I've never heard before, and I usually have no idea what's making that sound, but I think it's really exciting that there is still so much to explore and learn.
And what of Sven Foyn, whose fiendish technologies made whaling so efficient? By 1881, Foyn, who suffered from rheumatism, liked to spend time in the baths in Sandefjord. He was, at this point, a wealthy man, 72 years old, with no children. When a competing whaling company was established in Sandefjord at that time, Foyn decided to invest. And the name of the company? Håpe, the hope. I don't think I can end an episode on whales without quoting from the great American writer Herman Melville and his novel Moby Dick. Even though the book is really about one man's obsessive pursuit of a whale that crippled him, it's also a treatise on the ocean itself, on whales, on the environment, and much more. Melville could have spoken for many a curious acoustician when he wrote, "There is, one knows not what sweet mystery about this sea, whose gently awful stirring seemed to speak of some hidden soul beneath." I'm Nancy Basilchuk, and you've been listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. My guests on today's episode were Martin Landre, Jennifer Bailey, Leia Buffo, and Anna Shirovich. If you want to know more about the research discussed in this episode, check out our show notes. And if you've enjoyed today's show, consider leaving us a review or telling your friends to listen too. Sound design and editorial help from Historia Bruke. Thanks for listening.